Hello, freedom friends, and welcome to the Reason Podcast Monday edition. This is where we sit around with my Reason compadres and comadres, Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. I am Matt Welch here. We have a lot to get to today, not least of which is tax reform, Paul Ryan, and porgies, for crying out loud.
There's no Suderman in porg.
Yeah. Yeah. Come on, Grandpa, get with it.
As you can tell, this is going to go off the rails sooner rather than later. But before all of that, please go to iTunes, subscribe to us, rate us, and review us, and do things like that to us while you're there, because it helps other people figure out whether or not they should subject themselves to this kind of wisdom on a regular basis. So tax reform is going to get passed tomorrow. We're recording this on Monday morning. Hopefully you'll be listening to this on Monday afternoon. The vote is scheduled for Tuesday, and despite at least a couple of senators being sick, it's going to pass with the flipperoo of Bob Corker in particular, and also Susan Collins and elsewhere. And I want to sort of set the scene maybe by having us engage in some of the criticism that we've received. We've talked a little trash about tax reform in this podcast for a variety of reasons. A lot of it having to do with the rushed process and then also its effect on the debt. But a lot of people out there are saying, hey, there's some good stuff there, too. So, Suderman, I'm going to start with you, since at some point you were at least talking about writing a piece about, hey, there's some good stuff in here in the middle of all the negative. So what from your frame of mind is good to begin with the tax reform that we shall see passed probably on Tuesday?
It cuts the corporate tax rate. This is a real long-term goal. That it's going to do, and it cuts it permanently. And in fact, that's sort of the whole bill is in many ways just a big corporate tax rate cut. And that's a good thing, I think, especially if you sort of think about it outside of the context of the rest of the bill. That is just a goal that limited government folks have had for a long time, have argued, I think, correctly that the United States is not competitive internationally. You even saw President Obama points and his economic advisors say that it should be lower than the 35% that it's been at for forever. Now, they didn't want to drop it down to 21%, which is where it's going to get, which is where it's going to end up now. But they were saying basically it should be in the high 20s, maybe even in the mid 20s somewhere. And I think that that's something that that is just a good thing. Again, if you kind of take it out of context, my issues with the bill end up being kind of the package of things where all of the individual cuts expire after about a decade or a little less, and where it raises the deficit, even if those individual cuts do expire. I think the individual simplifications don't go as far as certainly as far as the House bill, which had dropped the 7 tax brackets down to 4. And so I think in a lot of ways this bill is a missed opportunity. And a rushed bill that wasn't put together, I think, with the kind of care that that a better bill would have been. But that said, it's going to give individuals a tax cut. Basically, everyone. It's the Senate bill, according to the Tax Policy Center, would raise taxes on about 7% of people. The revised version that the House and the Senate have put together that number is probably going to be even smaller. And so this is going to be a tax cut for most people. That means more money in their pockets. That's a good thing. Again, kind of if you take it out of the context of the deficit. And it's also going to reduce corporate tax rates permanently in a way that I think is just net valuable and necessary for preserving the United States' international competitiveness.
25-second follow-up, Peter. Wait, just quickly here to rebut an MSNBC point to amplify it, let's say, is if you cutting the corporate tax rate has never worked in terms of job growth and creation. Trickle-down economics is a failure. What say you, Peter Suderman?
I think that advocates of cutting the corporate tax rate are dramatically overstating the effect it will have on growth and jobs in the short term. However, I think it puts the United States on much better footing in the long term to be competitive internationally as a place to do business.
Nick, go ahead. You're talking.
Yeah, I was going to say that what also is in there, which is good regarding corporate taxes as well as individual, is that it shifts from a global system of tax collection to a territorial one, meaning that corporations and individuals will no longer be taxed on all of their income wherever they make it in the world, which is an exceptionally rare and bad idea. And the United States was one of, you know, two or three countries left doing that. Libya was one of the countries that did that before Gaddafi was crushed. So, the corporate side, I interviewed both Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform as well as Chris Edwards, the director of tax policy or fiscal policy in at Cato last week, and they were both bullish on the corporate side of things, and I think it does make sense. I share it's in the long run. We already currently the highest corporate tax rate that American corporations will pay is 35%. That's well above the OECD, the industrialized average of about 20%. This is good. It brings us back into the ballpark. And with that shift from global to territorial taxation, it makes it easier for businesses to be located here, headquartered here. So that, you know, that's all good. Edwards, and I agree with him on this, that when you look at the individual side, this is very much like kind of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. It is not really addressing anything that has to do with the spending side of the equation, which is a big, big problem. And the Republicans, Matt, you and I, everybody on this call has talked about how awful the Republicans have been about any kind of fiscal restraint. This does nothing, you know, to do that other than blow out the deficit even more. Some of the good stuff, though, is that it does get rid of or it introduces into legislation and hence national conversations things like getting rid of broad-based tax expenditures, otherwise known as deductions for things like state and local taxes or SALT taxes. It limits the mortgage deduction. I wish it had gone further and actually created a flatter system where there are very few deductions or exemptions on national taxes and pushed states to actually compete based on how they tax things, what level of taxes they give and what level of services. But for me, the corporate side is good. The individual side is kind of a shit show. And it's primarily because overall, as Peter was talking about, the bill doesn't, you know, it was passed under rush circumstances, which is not good. It's all partisan. Like Obamacare, this is going to be fully one party's bill. It doesn't mean there aren't some good things in it, but it's a continuation of the kind of polarized politics that in the end are not particularly good for the country. And when you look at the deficits that we're courting with this, it's potentially ruinous in the near to midterm, actually.
Catherine, you're an anarchist. So the criticism that I get from your friends in the Free State Project, broadly speaking, and I'm just going to fit as many. This is like Tom Hartman radio here, like 2 minutes of like preamble about all the things that you may or may not believe. No, what you hear is that, hey, reason. So with all your deficit and debt harping, that means that basically you're against every tax cut when, in fact, tax cuts have nothing to do with the deficit because it's our money. Damn it, Catherine. What say you?
So one, taxation is theft, obviously. I do think that's sort of a thing that's worth saying periodically during the tax reform debate. Like, it's true. It is money that the government is taking from people and using for various mostly shitty purposes. And we should always, always, always keep that in mind. Because we have now gotten ourselves in a situation where, according to very preliminary estimates from the Joint Committee on Taxation, the bill that we're looking at now is going to increase budget deficits by more than $1.4 trillion over the next decade. That's so much money. Oh my God, that's a lot of money. And the reason that it's $1.4 trillion is because the Senate arbitrarily set itself a rule that it could not increase the deficit by more than $1.5 trillion. So like some kind of shitty college student fiddling with the margins on their paper in order to make it up to the exact edge of the page count on exactly on the deadline, that is what Congress has done. $1.4 trillion more in deficit over the next decade. That's batshit. And I think it's important to keep that in mind when we're talking about all the little fiddly bits. And yes, it is true. People should be able to keep the money they earn and the government should do less. But the government does more and now there's more deficits also.
And it's also batshit given that Republicans spent the entirety of the Obama administration complaining about Obama's way too high deficits and the way that he added to the debt.
Darn day. Paul Ryan, especially. I'm looking at you, Paul Ryan. You're dead to me now.
And so the other sort of thing that I always think when you hear this objection, well, it's our money, we should just be able to keep it and don't worry about, like, let's just reduce taxes and reduce taxes and not worry, you know, even if we're not reducing spending, is that in the long run, you're not really letting people keep their money if you keep spending.
You're stealing money from your grandchildren.
But here, let's be clear, though, too, that in the context of a tax bill, it is wrong that people who own rather than rent get to deduct mortgage interest. So even, you know, and I, as a libertarian, as opposed to an anarchist, I don't believe that taxation is theft. I believe that there is going to be some level of government and it's going to be funded by taxes. It's going to be funded by theft and with men with guns,
by membership fees,
et cetera. You know, it's like whatever. But having said that, you can make it fairer or not. And the government, the primary role of taxes is to raise the revenue necessary to pay for government. This bill fails on the face of that test, but it does move towards a better system where it says, you know what, like, you know, mortgage interest on two homes is no longer deductible, up to $1 million no longer deductible. And, you know, it's up to us who aren't happy with this bill or with the Republicans or Democrats to start arguing, making the case for, you know, a tax system that we would actually be more comfortable with. And I think that is one that says you don't get to deduct healthcare, compensation that your employer pays for. You don't get to deduct state and local taxes. You don't get to deduct property taxes, even, which is in this. You don't get to deduct anything. Every dollar should be treated the same because the government shouldn't be in the business of saying, oh, this is a good spending, this is bad spending. You know, screw that. The government is there to raise money to do a few things and to do them competently.
And I actually do think that's the right way to evaluate a tax bill in the end. It's how distortionary is it? And you have to include every distortion. So it's not just the sort of, oh, should we defund PBS level of fiddling about mortgage interest deductions? It's also, how does this distort our economy in the long run? How does this distort the relationship of the U.S. to the world? How does this distort decision making about where people locate their new businesses or what stock market they list in or where they live in the long run or whether they want to emigrate here? There's, you know, the goal is to create a tax system, if we must have a tax system, that is minimally distortionary. And our current tax system, and in fact, all taxes, are basically just ways of letting politicians change our behavior by taking our money selectively.
Speaking of which, another thing that this bill does is it repeals Obamacare's individual mandate. And as I've said before, this is sort of a partial victory at best, the individual mandate. I argued before it got to the Supreme Court, you know, I said, and I still think that it should have been ruled unconstitutional. The Supreme Court, of course, ruled that it was constitutional. So that point is sort of moot at this point, but it's not going to be law anymore. And that is going to have some really interesting effects on Obamacare, which will still exist, which the rest of it will still exist. And so that means, in particular, the pre-existing conditions rules, the subsidies for people buying on the individual market if they make less than 400% of the poverty line, and perhaps biggest of all, the Medicaid expansion. And so in some ways, one of the kind of side effects of this tax bill is going to be to turn Obamacare into a program that is less of a kind of a middle-class subsidy and a little more of a kind of traditional expansion of the social safety net.
To that point, Peter, and also kind of knitting together the taxation is theft angle, one person who's been arguing that this tax bill is theft is not a libertarian, but Bernie Sanders. He's walking around and saying, this is a massive thievery from the middle class to the oligarchy.
Was that your John McCain or was that your Sanders, Matt?
I got to have a lot of
Bernie.
A lot of tools in the box. The oligarchy was not bad. But can you address that claim and maybe sweep the Obamacare stuff into it of that on net? This is the middle class taking it in the shorts to make the McRichies McRichier, Peter.
Well, to some extent, if you cut if you want to do a big corporate tax cut, that the primary direct benefits are going to flow first to people who make a lot of money and who are wealthy. Like, that's just sort of unavoidable. And so, like I said, even under Obama, that we were talking about cutting the corporate tax rate down, not this much, but from the level that it was at, because basically everybody agreed that 35% makes the United States uncompetitive. And in addition, it encourages corporations to do a lot of kind of weird workarounds where they end up paying a lot less than the 35% that they are sort of supposedly taxed at. In terms of Bernie Sanders, part of what he has argued is that this is a backdoor way of cutting entitlement spending. And so he has said, well, first we're going to cut the taxes and that's going to raise the deficit. Correct. And then what they're going to do is they're going to argue, and now the deficit is so high that we just have to cut entitlement spending. And Marco Rubio and Paul Ryan, who we can talk about in a little while here, have in fact said, well, the next step is to start entitlement reform. And I will also say everybody on this podcast thinks entitlement reform, in particular Medicare reform, is a big deal. It is the biggest driver of the debt in the long term. Again, President Obama said that. But guess what? Guess what? This tax bill, if they pass it as we expect them to, and if they don't do anything else, it triggers some automatic cuts to spending, including to Medicare. It would trigger about a 4% cut per year, a few billion dollars. Not nothing, but a relatively small cut. And one of the things that Republicans did to ensure the passage of this bill was absolutely promise that they would never let these tiny cuts go into effect. That is how serious and how dedicated they are to cutting entitlement spending. And so that, I think, is what we can expect going forward.
On the question of who gets the biggest tax cut, according to the Tax Policy Foundation, and these are using 2014 numbers, there's, if anything, it's gotten a little bit worse, but it's something like the top 1% paid about 46% of all income taxes. The top 1%. Now, they might have a higher share of income growth than that and stuff like that. But of course, the people who are going to get the biggest tax cuts are the people who pay most of the taxes. It's like the top 20% of incomes, which is people with incomes over about $130,000, contributed about 85% of all federal taxes. So if you cut taxes, it is going to go to mostly wealthy people. At the same time, this is going to help what anybody would consider middle-class people, you know, somewhere between $40,000 to about $100,000 in income. It is going to flow to their pocket. One of the biggest problems with this bill, actually, is that it takes even more people off the income tax rolls. And the reason why that is a problem is once you de-link government benefits from government costs, which is what happens. We already have almost half of people in America live in households that pay no income tax whatsoever. You forget that government services actually cost money. And that's an ongoing problem here because, you know, for decades now, and especially in the 21st century, we've been, you know, borrowing 30 cents, as much as 40 cents on the dollar of what the government spends in a given year has been borrowed. And it's, you know, we all know this from our personal behavior. If you're getting a dollar's worth of stuff for 60 cents, for 75 cents, for 85 cents, you're likely to pay more. If you're spending nothing and you're getting that, you're going to pay even more. You're going to want even more. That's screwed up. And this is where, you know, taxes are one thing. They're necessary to raise the revenue for government. They should do it in a transparent way, in a non-distorting way, and all of that. And everybody should pay something and should openly pay something. And then government programs should be, you know, spending programs and transfers should be more transparent. This doesn't help with that. Sanders is right in the sense that as the government goes bankrupt, it will eventually have to reform entitlements. It's a damn shame, as Peter
Sanders was definitely
noting,
not saying we should reform entitlements. He was saying,
he's right.
Outcome that will happen as a result here. Yeah. And I think,
and the problem is if you means test Social Security and if you means test Medicare, that's not the worst outcome in the world, because it's not going to be, you know, it's a shit deal, but it's an even worse deal for the younger you are, the worse a deal it is, because it's not going to be around for you anyway, but you're going to be paying more and more taxes to get less and less out. That's, you know, that's the real crime. And both Democrats and Republicans are complicit in it. And we really do have to foment generational warfare. And by generation, it's the youngs versus the olds. And at this point, olds are anybody over about 55 or 60 for sure. Like, they need to take the haircut.
Part of that. Yeah, Nick, but also, shouldn't we, in the context of talking about what income quintiles pay, what percentage of taxes – speak not just about federal income tax, but also about payroll taxes, which are by definition regressive and not progressive.
Yeah, I agree with that. And depending on what finally ends up in the income tax bill, some people will be getting credit on their payroll taxes. But here's one of the things. Payroll taxes go to pay essentially Medicare and Social Security. They are an income tax. You pay them on your income, on your weekly or biweekly or monthly compensation. It is so far past time that we stop this accounting fiction that FICA taxes are somehow different than everything else the government collects. And those should be wrapped into a discussion of income taxes. Because it isn't as if that money is put in a separate account,
a lockbox,
that you have a claim to. Yeah, the lockbox, which, the lockbox, it's hilarious when you go back and you look at the 2000 election and what Al Gore was saying as a way to shore up Social Security. He was going to put Social Security taxes in a locked box so that it was actually tagged for you in the future. It hasn't been that way in forever. It's never going to go back to being that. And this is part of the fundamental 21st century restructuring of government and of reality we need to get into. The fact is that Social Security and Medicare are premised on demographic presumptions that are absolutely no longer usable or meaningful in any country in the world. And we need to get over that, and we need to start rethinking entitlement spending. And, if you want the American economy to really take off and go into the future, it would be great if we were having that discussion. And I think we're still a ways away from it. Maybe this tax bill, by starting certain conversations, and especially, Grover Norquist, who I think is full of gas on this, said, the Republicans are going to start reforming entitlements in April. I really doubt it, because as Peter was saying, that would suggest that they're going to talk about cutting spending, especially to old people. And if you look, the only people who are voting Republican in reliable numbers are old people. So, I'll believe it when I see it, but that's what we need to be doing.
Remember Obamacare? Remember the 2012 election where Mitt Romney ran against Obamacare? His biggest argument was Obamacare cuts Medicare to fund Obamacare. I would never do that.
Also, by the way, Mitt Romney lost that election basically on an argument that, Nick, you were making earlier about how people who don't pay for government aren't bought into the idea of the American experiment. So there's that piece of it, too, that, I think the class warfare of this can only intensify.
And
but I don't think this tax bill hasn't started any discussions. This tax bill has unsatisfactorily ended a discussion that was not going anywhere anyway.
Well, let's talk about that, Catherine. Mitt Romney's vice presidential candidate is your ex-boyfriend, Paul Ryan. You guys were on the kibbutz together in Ancapistan. And
Jesus
why not?
Christ, well.
Why not?
Well, the anti-Semitism, go for it, man.
Paul Ryan first came to prominence he was a young gun. Is that what we used to call those guys? They were like,
he was one of the young guns. All of them, with the exception of him, are either out of office or under a cloud.
So, Catherine, speaking of all of this, Mitt Romney's vice presidential pick in 2012, Paul Ryan, your ex-boyfriend, as far as I have it on good authority, this is what he made his politics about for a long time. This is why he was famous. He was about the mathematics. He was in the house gym doing curls with copies of Atlas Shrugged. And he cared about long-term entitlement reform. He's going to make it front and center, and the debt is going to sink us and all this kind of stuff. We have reports, which have been somewhat denied, but that he's thinking about piecing out after the end of his latest congressional term and no longer being speaker. Should we see this moment, even though he is seeing it as a triumph of finally passing tax reform, as in fact his failure of the one thing that he was really supposed to be all about, which was reforming the looming entitlement state in the face of the baby boomers being older and worse than ever?
So the arc of Paul Ryan's career has basically coincided with the arc of the death of hopefulness in my heart about American politics. And I say that as his ex-girlfriend, obviously. So when I first started out at the Weekly Standard, I interviewed a newly arrived Paul Ryan on Capitol Hill. I went to his office where at the time he was like one of those guys who slept in his office, you know, because he was like bachelor guy. I think he still is, but like only notionally. He had a bunch of copies of Atlas Shrugged that he was divvying out to staffers. The piece I wrote for him, we illustrated with a photo of him holding the head of a buck that he had shot with his bow and arrow. I was like, DC, it's amazing. This dude got elected. This is going to be great. And then it's like, you know, he made his good little plan for entitlement reform. And I was like, this is sounding good. He's rising in the ranks. He's in the committees. I'm like, yes, there's hope. There's hope. Maybe reform can be a reality. And then the like just total slow motion collapse into the pragmatic Republican politics that he chose to participate in. And I think for Paul Ryan, it was the right call, right? He was like, okay, I'm going to seize power and do my thing. That's my path to success, as opposed to the kind of Ron Paul variant of just, you know, sniping from the sidelines, which has its value. And this is what happens when you try that. Where we are right now, when someone with the best intentions and actual knowledge and principles does his level best, succeeds up to the highest echelons of power, what you get is a best case scenario at this point is that he gracefully rides into the sunset because he's failed.
Hey, you know what, though? There isn't a single massive expansion of government that Paul Ryan during his career didn't vote for, especially if there's a Republican in power.
Right, but that's he was clearly a principled person who made a bunch of pragmatic choices with a big win at the end game. And he's not going to get the big win.
He's saying
he did, but he didn't.
I think that his principles are, you know, his principles are not libertarian at all. They were not towards limiting the size, scope, and spending of government. His rhetoric was, but he was in favor of No Child Left Behind.
I think Paul Ryan believes, and, you know, God knows that what lurks in the hearts of men. But my guess is that Paul Ryan believes that everything he did here in his time in Washington was basically in the service of attempting to get the U.S. government on sounder fiscal footing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't know what's in his inner mind and all of that, but he proposed, you know, he voted for No Child Left Behind, for the Patriot Act, for all the wars continuously and every defense increase, you know, unknown to man. He voted for Medicare prescription D, or was in favor of these things. He was in favor of every tax cut that a Republican could come up with. He was in favor of TARP bailouts. All of this, he is the quintessence, I think, of the modern Republican or the contemporary American Republican Party that doesn't understand that limited government means cutting spending as well as cutting taxes and cutting, you know, and that's really, really fascinating to me.
Paul Ryan is vilified by every Democrat in this country because they know that he wants to cut spending, because he wants to cut entitlement.
Yeah, well, I agree. And this is a false argument. Yeah.
Right. He wants to reduce
His Medicare plan was not to actually reform Medicare in any kind of meaningful way. It was to put in, you know, a limited amount of money that seniors would get around 2040 or 2050 to bring down the premium costs so that Medicare suppliers would have to compete. That's like such a fake and phony hope that somewhere down the line, by limiting the amount of money.
I get why you don't like the way that he voted.
Well, I'm saying he's not.
No. But answer me this question. Is there someone that you can think of who either actually is on the Hill, who is more principled, but trying to do an engagement strategy rather than an outsider strategy? And or can that person exist at all? Is that just not a thing? Because in that case, why are we engaging in talking about legislation?
That's a good question. And I do think that people like Justin Amash and Thomas Massie, who are not perfect libertarians by any stretch, and I think, you know, people like Mike Lee and Rand Paul, for instance, are actually principled. They make compromises in politics and things like that, but they are talking about fundamentally different ways to deal with the immediate and looming challenges of government spending and things like entitlement programs. So there are some people out there. None of them have been as effective as Paul Ryan in climbing the ladder and moving from certain types of positions within the Republican Party to the, you know, Speaker of the House. And to give him credit, or to give him a little bit more time, we'll see what happens. If in fact he's going to retire, you know, at in 2018 at the end of his term, we'll still have he'll still have a shot at starting entitlement reform. There's no way that it'll get done between, you know, the spring and next January. But he might actually lay out a serious plan there. But then the question is, what are we doing? You know, and it's like, you know, the role of libertarian journalists and libertarian policymakers isn't to compromise immediately. It is to come up with pragmatic, workable plans. We have to shift the grounds of the, you know, common view or the consensus view on things. And like the fact of the matter is that everybody in Washington, everybody knows that the entitlement state as we inherited from 19th century Germany through Roosevelt, through Lyndon Johnson, through Ronald Reagan, who jacked up payroll taxes that we're still paying for, you know, through George Bush, through Obama, it is unsustainable. And we need to be the people who lay out why that is. And here is an alternative that is workable, that will take care of the most at-risk people who cannot handle life themselves or need a hand up, and get out of this mess. Because everywhere around the globe, you know, the idea that you're going to have 30 or 40 people paying for every beneficiary, it's over in a world where global population is going to peak very soon and start declining. You know, if America is supposedly the leader of, you know, the planet, we got to get ahead of that. And that's the role that we play, I think, is reshaping that and showing how people who are free will be more prosperous and will be better off in the near term as well as the long run.
Peter, you wrote a feature on Paul Suderman for Reason Magazine that people should go read. You also wrote one on Mitt Romney, touching on some of the things that you talked about. I have a thesis, which is that Paul Ryan won't be able to do anything useful about entitlement reform, partly because the earth is now scorched from the Democrats' point of view. They all believe the Bernie Sanders logic. They will never believe a Republican again, at least until the next time, about that deficits are a problem that need to be addressed. But given all this, given Nick, given Catherine, what are your big feels about Paul Ryan?
I mean, I largely agree with Catherine. One of the first big magazine features I wrote for Reason when you were editor in chief was about Paul Ryan. And so I was kind of the jilted third wheel. I wished he was my boyfriend. And I mean, I was kind of jealous of the whole situation because I thought Paul Ryan showed a lot of promise back then. And I think you look at how he acted when he first came into Congress. Yes. He voted for TARP. He voted for No Child Left Behind. He had totally cast his votes for all of these big government programs that we don't like. But at the same time, where he actually made his mark was in drafting and introducing big legislative ideas. And that is something that you just don't see very much anymore from any legislators, whether they are at the top or whether they are in the backbench, but especially the kind of backbench young upstart types, you just don't see that happening. And part of the reason is that Paul Ryan, as Speaker of the House, has really centralized the process of legislative sausage making on Capitol Hill. And this is one of the frustrations that the House Freedom Caucus, which is in many ways the biggest thorn slash the loudest critics slash the people who are doing the best job of keeping Paul Ryan honest. This is one of the big frustrations they have. And also, you see something similar in the Senate, which Paul Ryan, of course, works pretty closely with under Mitch McConnell, where the process of legislation and making legislation has been entirely centralized. And lawmakers don't make law anymore. And it's really a kind of odd situation where Paul Ryan came up doing that and now has been one of the most active participants, leaders of ending the old idea that, like, if you are a member of Congress, one of your jobs is to come up with plans and sell them to people.
Yeah, I'm squarely in the camp of Nick on this. I have thought from the beginning that he was all hat and no kettle. Is that right? All tea, no kettle.
Well, look, I mean, there's always been two Paul Ryans, right? There's always been the kind of the somewhat wonkier sort of I like policy and I will go and talk to the small group of American enterprise Institute scholars and also give interviews to Peter Zuderman and Catherine Mangu Ward
Cheap dates.
Walk through the details of my plans and admit, you know, sort of some of the political difficulties. And then there's been the other Paul Ryan, which is the one who that kind of won out in this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde self-battle that he's had, which is I am a stalwart Republican and I vote with and support the party when it when that needs to happen. And he always kind of made the argument that being a good Republican was necessary to get to the entitlement reforms that he really that he backed. And I think, as Catherine said, that argument has basically proved it's not going to happen. And we are going to see how far being a good partisan can get you. And it can get you to be Speaker of the House and a deficit busting tax reform. But it's not going to get us the really hard stuff that Paul Ryan was promising and made his career on.
And again, it's not clear if he can't do it. It's not clear to me who can. And, you know, I think there were a lot of things that were right about him going in from a libertarian perspective, and he can't do it. What we have learned now is that he can't do it. And I don't think he's done it as Mitt Romney's vice president, but he also can't do it as Speaker of the House. And he's had, those were two good tries at doing
it. Matt, is it just that we're older and so we've seen this story? I mean,
yes.
This is
no,
like,
I
he's
just
like,
said, I mean, exactly it's just that it's because his rides coincided with my arrival in Washington. It is because you're older that you were already full of despair. But
no,
you
know, because it's like with Newt Gingrich.
The tree has to be watered with the blood of young journalists.
With the oldness of the despair and age.
I just mean it's like when Newt Gingrich came in and was going to, you know, have a massive Republican revolution. And, you know, it didn't happen. And it's because their ideals are wrong. Like if Paul Ryan got everything he wanted, we would not be in any better shape. The poor would not be in any better shape. And our long term fiscal reality would barely be different. And that's the problem. I agree that you don't see many politicians offering a new way of doing things. But Paul Ryan also was not breaking the paradigm. He was the guy who was going to keep it going a little bit longer. That's all he was offering.
You know,
pushing forward, you know, the Goddard-Damerang, you know, the budgetary Ragnarok, you know, that we were going to be facing. He wasn't actually transitioning to a sustainable form of government.
One of the ironies, many ironies about Paul Ryan is that the Medicare premium support, which was his big idea for reforming Medicare, was basically to turn Medicare into Obamacare, into the private market part of Obamacare.
But for old people, because they vote Republican.
So speaking of dashed childhood dreams, there was a new Star Wars film that came out this weekend. Did you, all three of you, see it?
I did not.
I did.
Catherine?
I don't know.
Catherine, you're not sure if you saw it or not? Are you in that much of a laudanum haze?
I was going to make a broad-based statement about how I don't go to movies because I have kids, and I also don't go to movies with star in them because I am a hashtag fake geek girl and part of the problem, but instead I just decided to go with no, and then it came out wrong.
Catherine,
right? I'm sorry, everybody.
You've read more science fiction novels than I have.
I know, but
you're
still
the opposite of a fake geek girl.
Thank you. You sweet talker, you. But in fact, this is exactly the sort of thing that, like, you can never be geek girl enough because there will always be some gap in your knowledge. And then it's like people are just diving in there with like, well, what does a porg really taste like?
Actual geeks feel like posers.
Can we say, though, that we're definitely having a porg roast here in the Reason office for Christmas?
It sounds like you're having one right now, hunched over that mic with Suderman. Suderman, so hashtag no spoilers here. But what I'm interested in, I've never seen a gap between critical response and audience response as I have with this. And we've covered the hell out of Star Wars over the years. We had a special issue a couple years back. Great videos, interviews. There's a great
Matt, you lived as Chewbacca for a month just as an experiment.
Yes. Oh no.
Good.
You know what, with the distortion on my microphone, I think that this whole episode has been Chewbacca. But it's the last time I looked, it was like 93% gave it, critics gave it a good rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and the audience is like 56%, which is kind of like the reverse that you would expect, I think, from Star Wars. So, Suderman, without spoiling anything, what's going on with that thing? Are we at a strange inflection point with this particular franchise? Does it tell us something about franchises in particular, or the weirdness of trying to serve audiences, or are critics all trying to guess what it's like to be a fan of something and missing the mark? What's with the gap?
I think that's the feeling that I have.
Did Chewbacca get his schlong cut in a zipper
again?
That's
the feeling that I had while watching Star Wars. I think Chewie really summed it up. The gap in critical and consensus and audience reaction is really interesting and unusual, and it's hard to think of another film that has as big a split. I think one reason is that Rian Johnson, the director who kind of comes out of the indie movie world, who's done stuff like Looper and Brick, is really popular with film critics. I really like his earlier films. And so there's just a lot of built-in goodwill towards him and his way of, and the kinds of films he makes and wants to make. And, you know, I also think there's part of the audience reaction is that it's increasingly difficult to come up with a Star Wars film that really just pleases everyone, because the expectations are so high and so broad that, I mean, Star Wars is in a strange but real way a kind of part of our national self-identity at this point. It is the biggest story franchise of the last 50 years. It is the one, right? You walk into any room of seniors, of kids in high school, of Gen Xers, whoever it is, and you can say, have you seen Star Wars? And most of the hands are going to go up. People don't just know that movie. They know
except
it by
Catherine's.
Heart in a way that people like used to know, you know, religious texts. And so when a property is that embedded into the kind of social fabric of what it means to be an American who it's just hard to think of anything that kind of unites people and connects people in the same way in our sort of increasingly kind of fragmented and fractured pop culture landscape. And so when you have a product like that, it's very difficult to find the middle ground that pleases everyone. And I will say, for my part, I had a really mixed reaction. I mean, in some ways, my reaction to The Last Jedi is similar to my reaction to the tax bill. Like, there's some good stuff in there. I don't think it works overall.
That was the most Suderman sentence that's ever been said.
Yeah.
Trying to imagine. I agree with
Peter that when you look at in a way that The Godfather functioned as a kind of text that almost everybody in America from, you know, the early 70s, at least through 2000, maybe 2005, could reference The Godfather. In an even much bigger sense, Star Wars is still doing that. And it allows us to speak. It doesn't allow us to speak with a single voice, but it gives us a common text to kind of interpret and participate with, et cetera. So I wouldn't worry about the split between the fan and the elite and the critical connection. I think to the extent that the critics like it more than the people, but, you know, this had the second largest opening. The only one that was bigger was the previous canonical Star Wars movie and The Force Awakens. And, you know, what you see here, this is like the place where we can still go and everybody can kind of see something similar and then remake it for themselves. And what we're also witnessing here is, this is what, a 45-year-old 40-year-old
1977.
Franchise now. Yeah. And it's being remade for a different audience and not necessarily like a different audience, a younger audience and an audience with different expectations. And, you know, just as when the second trilogy came out, a lot of people who were younger, Matt, who were, you're my age, you know, were like, oh, these movies suck, et cetera. You know, for my kids who were, you know, millennials or, you know, my older son was born in 1993, they loved those three you know, those first three Star Wars movies, because those are the ones they saw. I think it's fascinating to me that through no help of George Lucas or of Disney or of anybody, these movies create a world that people can inhabit and use to speak through and kind of bounce ideas off of each other. And to the extent that critics like this more than the lumpen proletariat, it's like, well, nobody gives a shit what critics think anymore. And that's not a bad thing, but they're still going to see it, which is also kind of interesting.
Catherine, you killed God. I had never really thought of having the discussion about movie franchises or Star Wars to begin with in kind of a God context that Suderman put. But it strikes me, and I don't watch all these damn superhero movies and the Marvel universe and the DC universe, which is failing, and all of these kinds of things. Is it a ridiculous? I've always assumed that the reason why you do that is that it's a big tent pole, and that way you get to print money if you latch on to a series that connects, and that makes it all worthwhile. But maybe the reason why those things can connect, or the impulse behind them, is because God is dead, or at least the audience is fragmented, and there's a thirst for that common vernacular that Nick talks about.
So I just pulled up a little handy Nietzsche for this discussion, and I think your question of God is dead, who we have killed him, you and I, who will wipe this blood off us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement? What sacred games shall we have to invest? Apparently, Nietzsche saw Star Wars coming.
And also predicted Festivus.
Or at least the Phantom Menace.
Can you read that in Yoda speak?
I wish I could. That would be such a great party trick, but no. Nietzsche as read by Yoda is a thing the internet needs. Podcast listeners, please get on it.
Despair? We have.
Oh, no.
You must have chaos within yourself to give birth to
it. You must have chaos within yourself.
Oh, dear God. Wow, I think besides being a signal that we should really put this one
to
bed.
Yeah, can we put this Death Star to bed already?
Let's fire the proton torpedo through that exhaust pipe.
Photon.
Really crossing the streams there.
Yeah. It also tells me that our Christmas episode should actually just be a Festivus episode that we were recording. I think that just... I don't want to give away too much, but our next episode is going to be special of the Monday version of the Reason Podcast. Reason Podcast has a bunch of other stuff. Nick interviews luminaries about pressing issues of the day. Grover Norquist, as he aforementioned recently, is one of them, and go check it out. But definitely, please, audience out there, go on to iTunes and subscribe, write and review us, and keep listening for more stellar things. Thank you very much. Have a good week and goodbye.